Hello, Bison. For those of you who are first-time listeners, my name is Brent Brozite, and I'm the Director of Development here at Nichols College. Welcome to this Nichols College podcast, which will focus on the stories and experiences of our Bison alumni network and beyond. Whether we're talking about building a business, leadership, the world economy, the stock market, philanthropy, or food, wine, and sports, you can be sure that this podcast will introduce you to some fantastic folks, and you never know who you'll pick up along the way. Today's guest is Tom McIlvaine, who graduated from Nichols in 1967 and who ran TBM Hardwoods before recently retiring and passing the leadership of the company to his sons Baird and Russell. TBM Hardwoods is a third-generation company which has an industry heritage going back as far as the American Revolution and the Civil War. Today we're going to talk a little bit about Tom's time at Nichols College, his family business, management, and I guess what you could call the forced innovation which was placed upon his leadership of the company during the financial crisis of 2008. Hello, Tom, and welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you, Brett. Nice to be here.
So I understand that earlier today you were a guest lecturer at a Nichols College management class. So how did that go?
Well, it was quite an eye-opener. I was very impressed to have the president, Susan, be the facilitator, and there were probably 25, 30 kids there, and they were seemed very engaged and some very good presentations and used TBM as a business study.
I know that last semester you got really high marks from the entrepreneurship class I had you speak in with Professor Flory. I was fortunate enough to actually sit in on that class, and it might be kind of strange for an alumni who once sat here in classes on the Hill to come back and actually teach a class at Nichols. So I guess this would be a good opportunity for me to ask, how was it that you ended up at Nichols College?
Well, I born and raised in the Philadelphia area, and I went to a local school there, Hereford School, and stayed there through eighth grade. At that point, I was flunking 3 out of 5 subjects. Mm. And somehow I ended up at Holderness School in Plymouth, New Hampshire. The headmaster up there took a flyer on me and let me go there. And that was a great experience for 4 years. And at the end of my senior year, I was the only guy at Holderness that didn't have a college to go to. And I was sitting in the headmaster's office there, and he called the Colonel Conrad down at Nichols College. He said, I got a guy named McIlvaine here. He can knock some people down on the football field and whatever. What do you think? And the colonel said, well, send him down. I'll take a look at him.
Wow. And all these years later, you know, here you are. I'm sure there were plenty of teachers who said, oh, that's not going to work out. And, you know, look at all you've done. So, you know, college experiences are used a lot by different people in different ways. So can you talk a little bit about how you use some of the things that you learned here at Nichols and took them out into the business world, you know, in your career in general?
Well, I think what really caught my interest at Nichols was the business administration side of life that I'd really never experienced. I certainly wasn't a liberal arts kind of a guy. And taking introductory accounting and taking a course in real estate and a course in law, some marketing, some management, some financing, public speaking courses, learning how to interview, taking some plant tours. I remember going to Framingham, Mass., going through the GM plant there. And all those things just started to sort of equate that, wow, you know, this is kind of one-on-one can make two kind of a thing, and I just kind of took to it. And one of the other things I really enjoyed about Nichols is that there were several people kind of like me that you know, really didn't excel very much in the secondary school, but could equate to basic common sense business practices, and there wasn't a lot of pressure here. So it was, I felt it was very practical.
I think that's one of the things I notice most about the students that I encounter here at Nichols is just kind of the grit, and whether they have a chip on their shoulder because it was like, the light came on late for me, or I didn't apply myself. I get that. I was more of a football athlete and president of the student council. And they have a lot of these experiences that they're doing outside of the classroom. And for whatever reason, when they get here, things click. So, you know, it's funny you mentioned a lot of the things, you know, case studies and going off site to visit businesses in Framingham, because that's a lot of the things that I think we still do to prepare our students for business careers. And I really like the dynamic of our students, that they are such strong leaders. And, you know, maybe for some of them, the light came on a bit late, but you just know they're going to go on and do good things.
Yeah, there's. I think the other good thing that I liked about Nichols is they had such a strong athletic program, and you know, being 1,000 kids, of course it was all male then. You know, you had a chance to play, and I think you learned so many lessons on the athletic field that you can also bring into the classroom.
And I know when there was someone from the Secret Service who had come out and they were talking to the students, and they kind of mentioned the same thing. They said, you know, if you've been playing a sport, you're a coachable person. You know, you've picked up leadership skills. You can follow directions. You know, you can get to your appointments and get to practice on time. And you're coming in pretty good physical shape, you know, to get through the academy. So I think it's the same, whether it's the Secret Service or the police force or you know, business executives, that sports, you know, for the students who do play an athlete, that's an intangible that, you know, I think really helps students out there in the field.
Yeah, I agree. I think also, certainly under the Colonel, he was willing to take, to give certain kids a chance. And I think that spoke well, actually, for him and for the faculty and the type of student that was here. So he didn't feel necessarily threatened. And that spirit kind of, there was sort of a safety net, you might say, mm-hmm. that if you had a problem, you could go and talk to them about it, and they're not a bunch of intellectual kind of people. That Nichols, I remember I love football, and my freshman year we lost every game. We scored one touchdown and missed the extra point the whole season.
Boy.
So they even had leather helmets back then. So by the time I graduated, Mike Vendetti, who was just a great coach, had taken the program a lot higher, and it continued to grow. And it was kind of fun to see that development as well.
Oh, some of those 70s teams. Yeah, I mean, those undefeated seasons. And so in my introduction, I went a little bit briefly into the history of your company, which is actually quite interesting. I always wonder how classes are going to react to guest speakers, especially in very specified industries that they might not know too much about, like the lumber industry. You know, but as I mentioned, the feedback was great. And a lot of them did remark kind of on the way out that your presentation was a lot more interesting than they thought it would be when they walked in, to the class. But can you lay out a little bit of the history TBM Hardwoods and maybe a little bit about what the company does?
Sure. The McIlvaines, of Philadelphia, there's actually a book that was written back, 200 and some years ago now called the Philadelphia Hardwoods, and it was about the McIlvain family. And for some reason, they got into the hardwood business and hardwood distribution. And my father was one of three boys, and they all worked together. They worked, their father had worked. And so they were the fourth generation. And then my dad split off T. Baird McIlvain, which is now TBM Hardwoods. He split off from them in 1950 and started his own hardwood business. And I was about 10 years old then, and I remember him coming home with helping him unload his car with all his files, and said, "Dad, what's going on?" He said, "Well, I'm out of a job, and your mother and I are going to go away for the weekend, and when we come back, we're going to decide what I'm going to do," which they did, and they came back. He said, "I'm going to start my own lumber business." So at that age, I was all in. And so every summer after that, I worked I worked for him in the summer in the lumber yard, unloading boxcars of lumber, and learned how to drive a truck. I learned how to smoke. I learned how to chew tobacco. I learned how to do all kinds of stuff that was kind of interesting. But I've always loved the business. I love working with my dad, and I got into a small company where I could see my efforts materialize practically in front of my eyes, and that helped build my confidence. And he was a great mentor, really knew the industry, and taught me a lot. And I like selling, so that's really where we started off. And after 54 years, I just hung it up.
So one of the things that we discussed the last time you were here, and it was actually a pretty fascinating conversation, was the importance of leaders in recognizing some generational changes which make up today's workforce, specifically the assimilation of generations X and Y, and then the world-famous millennials.
Yeah.
I noticed that you, even as a 1967 graduate, didn't have much trouble connecting to the classes that you were in. So as a leader of a company for so many years, what were you seeing in terms of the strengths and weaknesses of this new generation of employees? And these folks are going to become the next group of business leaders. So kind of what's your take on that whole dynamic?
Well, I think honestly the jury's out as to how it's all going to shake out. What I noticed probably in the last 10 years of my career is a lot of my customers retired and died off, and their sons would take over, or the company was bought and sold by, and younger people were getting in. And it became harder and harder to reach people by phone. Most of them want to do the texting now. And so you run the risk of losing a lot of the relationship interaction that's very valuable, really, in trying to consummate a sale or kind of describe, what it is you're really looking for or what it is you can supply. And you can't just put it all down in a text. So I think that's the biggest challenge going forward is the lack of communicating, the skills of communicating, and the importance of asking questions and trying to really build a relationship, which does take time. And so that's the challenge. The younger generation really, their mailboxes are usually full, and you get a voicemail when you call, so you don't talk to an operator, and so it's lost a lot of its in my feeling, being old school, it's kind of lost a lot of the fun of it.
Mm. It's one of the things I remember is, when my father was working, we would go on vacation for a week, and I don't remember. He may have been sneaking off to make a call or two, which I'm sure happened. But this generation, it's so different because we have these little phones in our pockets that are a mobile office, and I think the expectation has changed in a way that you can pretty much pick up the phone, answer an email, shoot it off. And that's kind of like, okay, that one's checked off the list, but you're right. I don't think they realize that should go hand in hand with cultivating relationships. And it is hard to do that when you have 30 characters or whatever it is.
Yeah. No doubt about that. Also, I think since the Great Recession, I guess, 06 to 08, which was the modern day depression, most people have had to multitask, and so everybody's time is being stretched to the limit. And even though we have these cell phones and everything else, you're kind of hooked to them, and it's the old you're addicted to it.
There's no getting away from it. Yep.
And so you're people almost feel whatever free time they have, they don't want to spend it necessarily shooting the bull with some salesman that they used to do. So it's a pressure-packed environment anymore, and it's changing very quickly, almost daily. There's no new norm, except you better be nimble, and you better be willing to strike when the opportunity is there. It's going to blow you by.
So what's the biggest lesson that you would probably give to college students or young executives today? Like, if you were to take one of the things out of your toolbox or one of the things that you've learned in business over the years, what do you think that would be?
Well, I think the ability to communicate, to carry on a conversation, to ask questions and listen to the answers, honestly, basic things like good manners, being able to speak well on your feet, a good firm handshake, look somebody in the eye, really have a desire to try to find out how you can serve them, how they want to be served. Some of those, just those basic things are, I think, slipping to a degree. And I think if you don't exercise those skills, you're going to lose opportunities to add value. And people, they still do want to be sold. They want to know why your price is higher or whatever, because you can explain that you can save them more money with less waste, less labor. And a lot of people don't want to spend that kind of time and make that effort to do it anymore. But we have been able to maintain that at TBM, and I think that's one of the reasons we've done so well.
And that can kind of, I guess, take us into the waters that you probably don't enjoy thinking about too much. But I think, you know, the phrase "every cloud has its silver lining" is a bit cliched. But in this case, in the case of your company in 2008, I think you can apply it there. So let's go back to the pretty unexpected economic catastrophe of 2008. You know, this is a time period where a tremendous obstacle presented itself to your business. So if you could just kind of talk a little bit about the things you as a leader and you as a company did in order to get the ship through those rough waters, maybe just kind of take us into abstract about, you know, the events and how you kind of adapted to a pretty unexpected problem.
Well, it happened so quickly, this housing bubble, so to speak. I guess that's what it was, but there wasn't a lot of noise that people were so far underwater with some of the investments they'd made in buying homes and borrowing money to the hilt. So it was almost overnight that suddenly a lot of our customers started laying off people, and they stopped paying their bills, and people were, they weren't buying their product, and up till that point, the whole economy was just going along kind of on automatic pilot, and you know, go ahead and build a beautiful house today, and put a little more gingerbread in it than normal because you can sell it next year for 10% more, and that was the attitude, and everybody was getting raises and making good money, and then all of a sudden that came to almost a standstill overnight. So here we were with 85 employees and doing about $55-60 million top line, making decent profit, making nice salaries, life's good, and all of a sudden, bingo. It's like overnight that stopped. Meanwhile, we owed the bank about $20 million on the line of credit, but it was all fortunately in good quality inventory, mahogany and walnut and cherry and so forth, that most of the high-end musical instrument companies were using. Martin Guitar, Allen Organ Company, Steinway Piano, Gibson Guitar. They were some of our big accounts. Plus, we had some good furniture manufacturers back then. And, of course, that all went away. All the manufacturing went over to China in a matter of really a year and a half. It was just gone. So here we were sitting on all this lumber and nowhere to sell it. Fortunately, we had a decent track record with the bank, M&T Bank, and but they were nervous. Anybody in the building industry was a marked person. A lot of the builders were going out of business almost daily. You'd read about them. And our bank, they got nervous. They came in. They wanted to raise my interest rate. They wanted to have more collateral. And I said, I kind of pushed back on them. And I said, look, you know, we've taken our staff from 83 people down to 19 in a year and a half. I hadn't taken a salary in 2 years. My boys, they cut their salary by 50%. The remaining employees we had took 30-40% salary decreases. We cut out all the gingerbread in the office. We cleaned our own office instead of having people come in and clean it. And we just cut to the bare bones. And every spare penny we had, we put towards the loan. One of the interesting things about it is we decided to have an auction because we had probably 10 times more inventory than we could justify, and it wasn't going to go anywhere. So we put we got an auctioneer, and that was amazing because I guess people don't have auctions unless they're going out of business. And so here's the McIlvain name. And everyone in the whole industry is saying, geez, McIlvain's going out of business and they're having this auction. And so we had 200 or 300 people come to the auction, which kind of put our name on the map a little bit more than we thought it would. And we actually accomplished what we needed to do. And we put our ego in our back pocket and said, you know, we don't give a damn what people think we're going out of business or not. We're going to get out of debt is what we're going to do and stay in business. And our accountant gave me this book to read called Confronting Reality, written by Larry Bossidy. It's a great read. And one of the main takeaways from that book was 80% of the companies that go out of business do it because they don't confront reality soon enough. And laying off people and cutting salaries, it can be very emotional. It's painful. And that's why a lot of people don't do it. But we decided, hey, do you want to have 19 people or do you want to have zero? And that's really what it came down to. Hmm. And
before you had the 19 people, what was the largest number of employees?
83. So in 18 months, we took it from 83 to 19. We didn't know where it was going to level off at, whether it was going to be 29 or 39 or 10. But the business stopped. We were, to this day, here we are 10 years out, and we're still doing 70% less business than we were at the high. So last year, we did $12 million worth of business. That's in 2018, but our margins are up significantly because people have only are buying what they need when they want it. So they're putting more demands on us to sort and pick and ship smaller quantities quicker and so forth. So we've redesigned our distribution where we could do that more efficiently, and we actually got our margins up about 20 points, which is unheard of. So we're actually making more money doing 70% less business.
That's and that's one of those things where I'm sure you were tearing your hair out for all those, you know, opening moments, but in the end it actually improved.
It was a blessing in disguise, actually. I think what really drove it was we had 11 salespeople that had been with us. Many have been with us 20, 30 years. They were making good salaries. Nobody was on commission in our business. And all of a sudden, when the shit hit the fan, a lot of their good customers stopped paying. And so suddenly, you know, a good customer, he's out 6 months, he owes you $100,000, and he wants another $20,000 tomorrow to finish the job. And we had to tell our rep, our salespeople, we're not going to take that order until he pays up. And they'd say, well, he's going to send us a check in 2 weeks, or he's going to pay half of it on delivery. And we said, nope, it's just out too far. Until he gets paid, we're not going to sell him. We're going to park the trucks. We're going to just sit here and wait. So we couldn't win with a sales guy, because then he knew he wasn't going to make his numbers. And then we're saying to ourselves, how can we afford to pay this guy $150,000 when he's only selling 30% of what he sold a year ago? And you couldn't justify it. So if you cut his salary, you're a son of a bitch. So we just decided, you know, we know these customers pretty well. And they don't want to see us that often anyway. So really, what value is that salesman offering? He's remote. We don't really know what he's doing half the time. So let's just try it. Let's just get rid of them all. So we did. And then the customers kept calling us. And the ones that owed us money, we'd go after them. I went to see every one of them. And 80% of them said that I'll get my money when they get their money. And I said, well, that's not going to work. And I said, you know, we've never sued anybody in 50 years. We don't want to have to take this to the next level, but you got to come up with a better remedy than what you just told me, because you got a dozen cars in a parking lot. You're still making sawdust. And I think the reason you're not paying is because we got rid of your salesman, and maybe you had a good deal going with the salesman. I don't know, but I want some money. And it's amazing. The ones that had the money that wouldn't pay us said, you do what you have to do. And I heard that, honestly, from five or six customers. I didn't know it at the time, but those are the ones that had the money. So we got a lawyer. 80% of the money was over in Long Island and New York. Those were where the big accounts were. And so we had to get a New York lawyer, and we did all that. And then they got the sheriff. And I didn't know this, but a sheriff can go right into the customer's bank and draw the money out of their bank account. And these guys that owe us $20,000, $30,000, 6 months old, the money was there. And we got it, about 80% of it.
So you're in a tough economy. Things are really, really bad. You have customers that aren't paying. I mean, that's where leadership and what we teach here at Nichols is leadership. You know, that's where it kind of, the rubber meets the road, I guess. You have to make a decision, and I'm sure it wasn't an unpleasant, I'm sure it was an unpleasant decision to trim staff and take people that you've had relationships with all those years. But at the same time, at the end of the day, like you said, you can pay 19 people or you could pay zero people out of business. Not easy decisions to make for a leader.
No, we knew it wasn't going to be easy, but it was the right thing to do. And we had some nasty phone calls from customers saying, you know, we were son of a bitch laying off that salesman, that we could have taken more money out of our pocket, and you name it. And they threatened to never buy from us again. And we said, hey, you know, I'm sorry you feel that way, but we're here, and if we can do business on a win-win relationship, we're all about it. So we started to get our confidence. And we also saw that our mistakes were going down. We didn't have as many people, so we weren't doing a lot of handing off. And we were dealing more directly with the customer. So instead of managing people, we were back to managing our customers, which is really where the fun of it is.
Mm-hmm. So speaking about fun, I sat in on the class that you taught for entrepreneurship for the day. And one of the things that hit me was most of us sit at a desk every day at work. Some of us live in homes or visit hotels with beautiful hardwood rooms, play an instrument, a guitar, whatever. Yet very few of us realize how the wood that they come in contact with every day makes it into their dining room or their table or the wall of their bank. So where does most of the best hardwood used in the United States come from? And what type of things is the industry doing to make sure that that resource stays sustainable?
Good question. Fortunately, the North American hardwoods, which is really the Appalachian area in the eastern United States and up through the Green Mountains and the White Mountains of New England, down through Kentucky, Tennessee, West Virginia, the best quality and most plentiful hardwoods in the world are right there. And it's actually, there's more hardwood growing, it's growing faster than it's being cut. And of course, it renews itself, the hardwoods. So there's certainly been a lot more a good stewardship in the forest to make sure that, you know, erosion problems and they're not overcutting and all those regulations that, frankly, we don't deal with because we're the middleman, but our suppliers do. But there's plenty of, my father told me that his uncle tried to discourage him from going in the lumber business because there wouldn't be any more wood to sell. And that was 100 years ago. And there's more, as I said, there's more hardwood to be cut today than there's ever been. So that's the good news. 80% of the North American hardwoods now are being cut and shipped overseas to China and Vietnam and all throughout Asia, because that's where all the U.S. manufacturing of wood products really went during the Great Recession or Depression, and it happened so quickly. Before you know it, 90% of the furniture business was 8,000 miles away. And so that's where the lumber had to go to build that furniture, but it was over in China and so forth, and then it was exported back here.
Will that shift back with now with the tariffs, you know, that have come through? And I mean, is that something that's going to hurt the industry enough in terms of the goods that are now being produced over there that might shift it back where North Carolina and even Gardner, Massachusetts might be manufacturing more furniture?
Well, I think the climate is certainly maybe trending in that direction, not to get political, but I think, you know, by us cutting taxes, cutting regulations, encouraging businesses to stay in the U.S., upgrading our infrastructure to support all that, that's all good news. Whether there's going to be, it's hard to say what the demand for hardwoods is going to be going down the road, because as we mentioned earlier, the millennials and so forth, a lot of them don't really, you know, beautiful hardwood furniture doesn't really mean a whole lot to them anymore. And they just happy to go to IKEA and buy a, you know, $100 desk that's thrown together with, you know, screws and glue, and they throw a piece of burlap over and it does the job fine. So I think the market has shrunk for hardwoods. I think there's always going to be a demand for it, but it's on the very, very high end. And actually about 70% of our business today is between Manhattan and the Hamptons. And that's where the big money is. And those where the people are putting in the custom moldings, the wide plank flooring, the custom stairs, the beautiful kitchens, the beautiful raised paneling. But in your normal $2 million house today, that's a lot of money. There isn't a lot of custom woodwork in there anymore.
So a really nice piece of furniture that you would say find in a executive's office or a Ritz-Carlton versus something that you'd find at IKEA or the Christmas tree shop. What's the difference between, I mean, how rare is it to find a piece or sell a piece of wood that would go towards making the best of the best versus, you know, the stuff that's sourced for cheaper stuff?
Well, there's no substitute for the Rue McCoy, and you can tell the difference. I think it's just personal taste, to be honest with you. Actually, brown furniture, meaning mahogany furniture, is kind of out of taste now. Nobody wants it. They want, if you, 90% of your kitchen cabinets today are painted, whereas 10, 15 years ago, 90% of them were solid red oak, solid cherry, solid walnut, because it was pretty. But today's generation, would they'd rather paint the walnut than look at it in the rough. So that's kind of interesting. One big market for us has become the wide plank flooring for homes, high-end homes. They love the wide, you know, 8, 10, 12-inch wide white oak. And some of them like the rift in the quarter because that really looks well. It lasts forever. And it can take a beating. And it certainly looks a heck of a lot better than some of the substitutes. But it's definitely a, it's a nice to have, not a need to have.
Mm-hmm. I think I sold you, I sent you an article a while back about, there was a study that was done in, I think it was Scandinavia, that said touching wood actually took people's stress level down. So there were actually companies that were making wood phone cases or wood keyboards because there was this study done that said touching actual, you know, quality hardwood would bring your stress levels down.
Well, I think there's something to be said that it's very soothing. And actually it also attracts, the people that are working with the wood, they're fine craftsmen. They take a lot of pride in what they do. It's a real talent to take a rough piece of lumber of walnut or cherry or mahogany and turn it into a beautiful molding or a beautiful piece of furniture. One of the interesting markets is the casket business. And there are certain ethical groups like the Hasidic Jewish people, when they die, they have to be buried within, I think it's 48 hours. And it has to be in a wooden casket, and it can't have any metal screws or brackets. And so that's a real specialty market. And they use walnut for it, and they put in beautiful silk lining to put the carcass on. Wow. And so there's still a couple of those little gems around that are nice to go after.
It must be weird seeing a famous Keith Richards playing a Gibson guitar or whatever he plays on television and know that your company had a little bit of a hand in that.
Yeah, that is fun. That's becoming a challenge too, because they want the guitar people want a certain kind of grain and density that's very hard to come by. And before, when the market was more fluid, you had an outlet for the stuff that they didn't want. Mm-hmm. In other words, they want the cream and you have to get rid of the milk. Well, now it's not so easy to find an outlet for the milk. And if you can't get rid of the milk, you can't keep coming up with the cream, so to speak. So there's all kinds of challenges, which makes it interesting.
Oh, yeah. Now I'll probably close on this question. So I was reading the other day, there was a BBC did a study or reported on a study by the Office of National Statistics Research there that said that ages 65 to 79 are the peak ages for happiness and satisfaction. The lowest recorded satisfaction and happiness years were 45 to 59, which I'm fast approaching. So as somebody who's recently retired and you're in that 65 to 79 happiness and satisfaction, what would you say the secret to being happy is?
Well, I think if you enjoy your work and you're passionate about it and when you go home at the end of the day, you feel you did something good for somebody, and of course you made a little bit more than it cost you. That kind of it's a game. Business is a game, like anything else. I was in it for 54 years. I Retiring was very difficult for me. It was the right thing to do because my two boys had been with me for one 18 years, the other one 13 years. And I said, when you're ready, you let me know. And they did. And we got the company evaluated, and the whole thing took about a half an hour. And shook hands, and I walked out, and I looked around, and I said, what the hell just happened? And it was like pulling the plug out, and there's no juice left. So, you know, from that standpoint, it was difficult, but it was sooner or later you're going to go through that. And I think for the tendency is for the old man to hang on, and then he becomes kind of dead weight and a pain in the ass, and really everybody loses. Especially in family businesses, there's a great book, anybody who's in a family business, called Beyond Survival, and it's written by, it's been out for about 30 years. My dad and I read it, and then my sons and I read it. It talks about the vulnerability of family businesses and the Ten Commandments of how to help protect family businesses, which is a dying breed, especially when you get into the third generation. But the bottom line is the old man wants to hang in there, and he feels nobody can do it as well as he did it, and he's just going to stay there till the end. And that's absolutely the worst thing I think somebody could do. So whether I had 54 great years, I loved it. It provided a great livelihood, and I was able to keep myself in good health and not take it too seriously, but I took it pretty seriously. And I feel like a very, very lucky guy that I had a chance to be part of a growing organization, and to be able to hand it off to my boys is great.
Well, if the Brits are right about this, you're heading into the the best years of your life. So,
well, I'm looking forward to it. I'm glad I'm here, actually talking to you and doing this podcast, and I'm sort of, this is my second trip down to Nichols to participate in the classroom, which I've never done before. I've always often wanted to be like to teach, and I think there's some things I'm exploring with Nichols where I might be able to be of help, and that would give me a lot of satisfaction.
Well, excellent. Thank you for joining us today, Tom.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Certainly you've had a real interesting and successful career, and we're proud to say that Tom McIlvaine is one of our Nichols College alumni. And thank you for listening to this Nichols College podcast. As a reminder, I'm always looking for guests, stories, and suggestions, so feel free to email me if you're able to add something to this experience. You can get a hold of me at the Alumni and Advancement Office at Nichols College. Brent Brozite's my name. This is a podcast which belongs to all Nichols College alumni, and as they say, teamwork makes the dream work, so feel free to collaborate in order to make this better and better. Thanks for joining us, and go Bison!